Will, I'm breaking orthodoxy here.
Wait, what?
I'm going to read an email before the emails.
But I haven't told the people don't. I just don't.
Willbot 5000 is breaking down. His robotic head has split open.
Techpod at content.town, go.
Jeez, man. I'm sorry. I know it's early in the morning, but wow. This email was, it's just, our life has been changed. Like, we hope to dispense tech advice to people to help them with their problems. But now, yeah, one among the people has helped us with one of our problems.
This is changing a workflow that has existed since time immemorial, since 2003.
Josh from Josh from St. George, Utah has changed everything by introducing us to Gmail tasks.
I've always seen that little bar on the right side of Gmail, and I've looked at it. I was like, this is annoying. I wish it wasn't here. And I've never, ever clicked on it.
This email has made me realize that I just ignore 90% of the Gmail UI.
That's the right answer.
And I have no idea what any of it does. Also, we'll get to it. I'm looking at the Gmail window here, and it's surrounded on all sides by UI. There are literally icon bars and lists of things around every edge of this email now.
There's something on the, I think the thing on the bottom is part of the Hangouts window, which apparently I've been told is going away soon. If you use Google Voice, you can keep calling and texting. So you have that going for you.
Wait, like the whole video conference thing in general is going away?
Hangouts. Look, Google has approximately 75 video and audio calling products right now. So, you know, Hangouts is the least popular. It's dead.
We use Google Meet a lot for work, which I think is basically identical to Hangouts, except it has a different name.
Nope, that's Meet. That's a completely different product, distinct in every way.
Of course. Yes, of course. Different quality of product. All right. Okay, let me just read this real fast. Josh from St. George. If you click the blue checkmark icon to the right-hand side on the web version of Gmail, it opens tasks. You can then drag emails to the sidebar, and it will create a task with the name of the email that opens the email directly when you click it. This is the crucial part. You can drag those tasks around to sort them. Leave additional notes on each one and mark the task as done to dismiss it from the list while keeping an archive of what you've answered. We have been searching in vain for the duration of this podcast's life. For a way to sort and order emails in Gmail.
Yeah.
To actually put them in the order we would like to read them before the podcast starts.
I've been using Gmail to answer questions on podcasts since like the Maximum PC No BS podcast started in 2005.
Wow. Jeez. 2000, really? That is an early ass podcast.
Maybe 2006. I don't know. Dan Morris, who was the editor in chief of PC Gamer at the time, was very excited about podcasting, and his enthusiasm was infectious. So I feel like you guys started around the same time we did.
Yeah.
I think we were maybe a little bit.
2006, I think, was the Hotspot debut.
Maybe it was 2006. I don't know. It was 2005 or 2006.
Yes. The heady days of iPods and podcasting.
I remember listening to the Hotspot before they were like, he gave us a list of gaming podcasts to listen to and was like, listen to the Hotspot, listen to this thing that the 1UP, or not 1UP, Ziff people are doing. And yeah, anyway, this is amazing.
Tasks, man.
I can imagine how this was created, because it has to be like somebody was sitting there. I was like, man, you know what sucks is everybody uses their email inbox as their task list. I wonder if we can make that better for them. And then here's this amazing thing that I've never even engaged with.
Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves. I'm not going to say the UI or experience is amazing.
It's transformative.
It exists.
I like that it has a little about down at the bottom. It says about, and then I can give help or feedback. If I hit about, it says, hey, how to use Google Tasks. Step one, open Google Tasks. Step two, create task or list. Step three, hide or reorder tasks. Nailed it.
Tasks, man.
Thanks, Josh.
Yeah, thanks, Josh. Let's stay on task and do this episode.
Welcome to Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod. I'm Will.
I'm Brad. Hello.
Hi. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. What's up? Hi. Still got the antlers. I see.
'Tis the season, man.
Man, I think I've missed my window. I'm afraid. Well, it is 9 days till Christmas.
Look, I'm going to go at this point. There's new windows opening up all the time. We talked about this last week. You got your New Year's antlers.
Mm.
You got your MLK Day antlers.
Oh boy.
You got your Valentine's Day. You can get some of those heart bobbers. Everybody loves a heart bobber. Yeah. Think about it.
I think you're really opening a can of antlers here that I don't think we're ready to address.
Look, you just need to get a bunch of zip ties and a bunch of shit that you can hang off your head. And people come into my Twitch channel and they're like, oh, I love your antlers. I mean, that happened once about 3 years ago. But
people like a little bit of holiday flair, it turns out. My mini Christmas tree has been kind of a hit on some streams lately.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when you're a green screen guy, you don't, man, that's a good looking tree. Wait, way.
Hang on.
You're aiming the wrong way.
The window is so small. I can't see.
There you go. Ah,
the lights turned on. That really plays on an audio only show, but I've got a little remote control for my Christmas tree.
Brad pressed a button. It would have been cooler if you like waved your hand and had the remote in the other hand. So it looked like you're using the force, but here we are.
I like a little wrist snap, you know, it's like, doink.
Yeah. Anyway, it's like, it's like, some wand magic or whatever, but, when you're a green screen person, you don't have a lot of opportunity to put stuff in the background.
Yeah. Or you have the opportunity to put everything in the background.
Well, I mean,
anything you can imagine.
During Extra Life, for a certain cash dollar donation level, I let people replace the background behind me.
Oh, wow. That is an amazing idea.
And let's see.
Well, except very risky. I assume you were able to vet what was happening. Okay.
Yeah, I filtered.
Did anybody try to do anything inappropriate?
I mean, remember that Men of Game Dev calendar?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Picture it. Dave Lang is behind my head for 1/32nd of the rotation.
And I said inappropriate.
I mean, he's... There's stupid nothing, sexy Lang.
There's nothing wrong with sexy Lang. Wow, that's a good creative idea, but I think back on what some of the stuff that has come in with donations in the past for stuff like that. Yes, I could see the risk there.
I reserved the right to reject any submission.
Okay.
No matter what.
To
be clear, some bunnies. The bunnies were very cute.
To be clear, what I'm talking about is that occasionally people will pay a small donation just to be able to write something horribly inappropriate.
And make it
appear on a live stream. Some people will do such things.
But, you know, I got to say, I didn't have any problems with that this year. Like, I've had that in the past. There were a bunch of MAGA things a few years ago, and this year it was just people chill, having a good time watching some video games and raising money for kids. So that was awesome.
That's good.
And you know, we beat Dave Lang, which is the thing that really matters at the end of the day. That's
all that actually matters in life.
Yeah. Speaking of, I was on GFB radio last week.
Oh,
how'd that go? And we talked about stuff.
We talked
about the tech pod a little bit. He wanted some podcasting tips.
Okay.
You know, it was good.
What did you tell him? Tip number one, don't compete with the tech pod.
Yeah, I told him we would fucking crush him and we would eat his children. And he seemed to take that pretty well, I think.
Okay, yeah.
He said he was going to come for me. And I was like, that's really nice of you guys. It'll be nice to see you again, Dave.
Yeah, he says things like that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Should we answer some emails that are sent to techpod@content.town, the official email address for sending emails to Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod, the official podcast of us?
Oh, techpod@content.town?
Yes, techpod@content.town, I believe, is the email address.
That's the one. We already answered one email.
What's our first email, Brad? But I got to ask, what's our second email? Because you're just shattering norms over here today.
Thank you to Josh. I know what our next email is because of Josh. I've got it right here at the top of the task. No, I don't actually.
This is like a business playlist. It's like you can playlist your biz.
Hang on. I gotta close the loop on this new workflow. Give me a second. Okay. So emails in Gmail the easy way. There's a little blue check mark next to it. Mark complete. Is that going to remove it from the task?
Yes,
it probably is. Cause I do need to remember what we talked about to write the description for the episode, but
it'll be incompleted down at the bottom. So you can always refer back.
It's
a task list. Yeah. Look,
wait, where is complete?
So you just filter by complete. Shoot. Yep.
Wait, so did you just
says
you
scroll down to the bottom where it says completed and marked out sorting emails in Gmail the easy way.
Oh, wow. It's got strike through font and everything.
It's amazing. This is I told you, this is a life changing. Josh has altered our lives for the better.
I love when things are different. Okay.
I'm going to put an asterisk on that one and move on.
I like good different. You know what it is?
Good different.
It's absolutely. It's implicit. I like when things change for the better. That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good thing.
All right.
Up and to the right.
First email says anonymous, please. How do I know when to trust when I Google a science or tech question? For example, I Googled, is fasting healthy for you recently? I get various sites with different opinions, citing different studies from different universities, and I have no idea how to navigate these results. This is in addition to different people in my life giving me different answers as well. This happens to me often these days when I look something up that I'm curious about. This also happened when I Googled about batteries earlier this year, but your episode of this podcast helped me a lot there. But in general, how do I know what sources are reputable? How can I tell if a study is legit? Is Google simply the wrong way to get scientific answers? Do some questions simply not have answers yet, and I have to live with that?
There's always an answer.
Well, yeah, but are we going to discover it in our lifetime? I don't know.
Well, okay, so there's a lot going on. This is a lot in this question.
Yes.
Don't get medical advice from Google.
At all?
Generally speaking, I would say. I was having a stroke last month, I Googled what are stroke symptoms? And it was like, hey, if any of these four things are happening, go to the ER. Yeah, I thought that was actionable and good, right? Mm. I used to say, trust those card pop-ups where Google extracts something from like the number one search result and puts it just on the search results page.
Those have to be algorithmic though, right?
Well, so for a long time the scrape was algorithmic, but the sources were vetted, and it seems like the sources are not vetted very well anymore.
Okay.
Yeah. So like, I can't remember, I was searching for something video game related the other day and it gave me some real questionable results. So look at the site that your results come from. So hospitals, like healthcare providers, health insurance providers, even. Okay. Okay. Sources, right? Like Medline, the CDC, the WHO, like actual Mayo government Clinic. Body. Mayo Clinic's a weird one.
Have I stepped in it?
So here's the thing. I'm afraid anything I say here is going to get results, angry emails. So I'm treading very lightly. Mayo Clinic seems really good. I've seen some stuff that seems a little sketchy on there.
Okay.
But it's not like you also know whether the sites you're looking at are edited, written by human sites or like user generated content sites. So, for example, anybody can edit Wikipedia. So if you're going to learn about some disease that you just found out you had, Wikipedia is not a great choice, maybe. Yeah. But the links, the sites that the Wikipedia article linked to are probably okay. So like think about just scroll down to the citations and go read the science articles about that.
Yeah, that was always a weird thing to me. I mean, this is going back 15 plus years at this point, but that was always weird to me about, for example, like universities saying like, oh, you can't cite Wikipedia in papers. Like, yes, I get why you shouldn't just go to Wikipedia and use their summary.
Yeah.
But like Wikipedia has always been exactly as good as the sources that are cited. Right. So like you can always vet the information by just following the citations and seeing who actually said it. Right.
The thing about Wikipedia. So now they let kids cite Wikipedia sometimes. Like my daughter can cite. She's 8. So it's maybe different rules, but
rigorous academic standards.
Well, but like there's no other encyclopedia, right? Like it's not like we have Britannicas anymore. Sure. Everybody just uses Wikipedia.
Yeah. So what if there was a print version of Wikipedia?
Oh, Jesus.
What if there was a bound volume set of Wikipedia?
Have we talked about this before? Did you understand how expensive encyclopedias were when you were a kid?
I mean, they're hundreds of dollars, right? I have some.
Well, like the World Book was hundreds of dollars. The Britannica was like $2,000.
Wow. Jeez.
Yeah. Huh. It was insane.
Man, I kind of wish I had like a late edition
of the last one was printed like 15 years ago. So
really? Oh, that's sad. That's a lot of space.
It is a lot of space. So, okay. So look at your sources, look at whether it's user generated or it's edited. If you're looking for product stuff, if you minus shop or store or buy now from the search results, just put a minus and then those phrases, then you'll get rid of all of the crappy kind of, you know, like, for example, I was searching for something this morning and I just kept getting, I searched for, the hell were we talking about right before we started the show?
Headphones? Velour headphones?
I was searching for eGPU enclosures for a question that's coming up.
Oh, you're spoiling the email.
Sorry. The first 10 or 12 results are all these, like, well, one is Amazon, and then others are these websites that I've never heard of before.
Yeah.
And when you go look at them, they're clearly just like click farms for affiliate links back to Amazon and Newegg. And like, that's not going to be super useful for the most part.
I ran into this problem a couple of weeks ago searching for something. I mean, this is way less dire than a health situation, but searching for Ryzen memory compatibility stuff.
Yeah. Good luck with that.
Like finding, you know, especially in that early release window before like the bigger tech sites had done their testing, it was like, who should I trust here? I've never heard of any of these sites. None of them seem to have like tangible YouTube presences. I can't really vet who these, you know, are they just trying to shunt me to like some monetized affiliate transaction? Like, can I actually trust what's being said here? I don't know.
So on the pure science stuff, the other way to look at it is to look at the big journals and science magazines.
I was going to say, like, familiarize yourself with like the big mainstream peer reviewed journals and what the kind of format of published articles are in those, because that's about as vetted as it could get, I believe.
Well, and I mean, kind of. So like when you're talking about stuff like Nature,
I'm sure there's some scientists in our community who would probably beg to differ with that.
Well, I mean, the thing is that they've all made mistakes, which is what happens. Well,
nothing is infallible. I mean, that goes without saying, or it should go without saying.
Well, and the point is, the point isn't don't make mistakes, because everybody does make mistakes. The point is acknowledge your mistakes when you do make them.
I mean,
and
that
correct
is,
them.
That is the pure iterative scientific process, right? Is to in fact, I mean, you know, again, that's where you might get into like some working people in those fields, you know, saying like, I'm sure some people succumb to dogma there at times and like are stubborn about. I mean, you see that all the time, right? Going back to like theoretical physics for through the ages, you know, it's like the kind of people cling to their strongly held beliefs even as new theories come along.
But I mean, also look at like the other place to look is stuff like Scientific American is actually like the editors there are good. Look at your good science communicators for science stuff. So Ed Yong and Aaron Biba and publications like Scientific American and even like more mainstream publications like New Yorker and Atlantic and stuff like that are Wired, where they have editorial processes and they presumably have writers and editors who are informed about the topics and are sourcing, like their citations are good generally. Yeah. So look for good citations.
Yeah. Also like on his last question, do some questions simply not have answers yet? Like they're definitely, especially in like nutrition, I feel like a lot of anatomical stuff, you know, you're constantly getting conflicting study results. You know, it's like, oh, fasting does this. No, it doesn't. It does the opposite. You know, like they're like, like human body processes seem especially difficult to ascertain like real truth about.
There's a lot of things that are in flux. And also we don't know like the long term health benefits or problems that come with things like, you know, high fat, low carb diets. And like we know the short term effects, which is that, you know, you burn a lot of calories and you lose a lot of weight. But we don't know what the long term effects of some of that stuff are, even though now we're, you know, with Atkins, we're earning like 30 or 40 years of people trying that shit. So the thing I would say is talk to your doctor about medical stuff if it's about you personally. If it's about science stuff, look at reputable second source publications like Scientific American. Avoid UGC sites like Forbes. Anytime you go to a Forbes.com site and it says contributor there, that's somebody who's either paid or being paid by them, but not being edited to just put it, you might as well be looking at Blogspot for that or Blogger for that. One of a person who has children older than mine, when our daughter was born, gave me really good advice, which is don't ever look up kids' sickness stuff on the internet when your kid is sick.
It's bad enough looking it up for yourself. I can't imagine when it's your child.
Well, right. He was like, there's a bazillion different books by hospitals and doctors that are like, here's everything you need to know about keeping your 0 to 2 year old alive. Right. So what you do is you buy that. We bought the Mayo Clinic version of that. We put it in the house, and whenever the kid was sick, we looked up symptoms there and we used that instead of going down the Google hole. Cause like,
yeah.
like if something if something serious happens, Google's great. You can find out where the best hospitals to be are, like what kind of experimental treatments and shit are out there, all of that stuff. But if like your kid has the sniffles or a fever or something, then like just use the book. You're good.
Yeah. Yes. It's a mess of information out there.
It's too much information.
Yes.
We're monkeys. We were born to live in trees and, you know, we're not, we can't cope with all every human having access to the entirety of the world's information. Be careful with it.
Indeed.
Great power, whatever. Mm-hmm. Searchability.
Yes. Yes. Hang on. Let me just write down the episode title there. Well, I lost track of the email. Oh, here we go. Jacob writes in. Wondering if y'all could wax philosophical about the similarities and differences between digital app stores on gaming consoles versus the Apple App Store issues that are angering regulatory bodies and the Tim Sweeneys of the world. Is it the relative level of ubiquity of the iPhone that makes the closed nature more problematic? I've wondered this exact same thing as Apple is the target of a bunch of antitrust action in Europe. And there's, again, the Tim Sweeney Epic stuff going on. There's like, you know, there's all these questions around like their revenue split with developers of apps on the App Store. Mm-hmm. When exactly, as Jacob points out, like that revenue split is pretty standard across Xbox Live and the PlayStation Store and Steam and like all of these other like gaming stores and similar, you know, software platforms are kind of identical, and nobody is like out there banging the drum about regulating them or, you know.
So how many people, how many Xbox Ones exist in the world?
Xbox Ones?
Yeah.
Several
hundred million?
Dozen million. They may have gotten to 100 million worldwide.
How many,
I don't know.
How many iPhones exist?
Yeah. I mean, is that really what it is? Is it just a scale problem?
Smartphones are general purpose computing devices. And for many people, they're their only computer. Right? Okay. Like they're their primary computer.
So this is a basic necessity versus luxury item kind of thing.
Yeah. And consoles are luxury items.
Yes,
so
for sure. Yes. Nobody is going to like fail to get a job or like not be able to get a doctor's appointment or something like that
because
they don't have an Xbox or a PS5. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's exactly sense. It. Yeah. That makes sense.
I think you can argue that those are closed markets and closed platforms and that thus they should be regulated more than they are, which I don't necessarily disagree with. But I think like the Apple versus Tim Sweeney, and now Facebook has entered that fray seemingly on the side of Tim.
I missed that.
It just started happening. I think it just happened yesterday, but basically they're saying, look, Apple's anti-competitive in a bunch of really important ways that fuck over our ad revenue. Because Apple, Apple flipped the switch on like disabling cross app and cross browser tracking stuff on iOS. It's the default now instead of an opt-in.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So that is impacting Facebook's business, presumably.
It's just interesting for Facebook to be out there saying things like that, given recent goings on in our government with respect to Facebook.
Look, there's a whole other, like the Bamas? No, Google. Fangs.
Yeah Facebook, the fangs. Apple, Amazon.
Shit's about to get weird.
Netflix, Google.
I've been rereading Neuromancer, and it feels like we're entering the age of corporate warfare. Like, oh boy. Really?
Wait,
it's not good.
Are they literally going to start hiring standing armies?
Look, I think
is there going to be an Apple militia?
I hope that I can't imagine anything grimmer than an Apple. Like every time you buy a new iPhone, they come out and they clap for you. Ugh.
Remember when the term PMC started sounding quaint for a while? It was some funny 2008 Metal Gear Solid stuff, but we might have to dust that one off.
God, what if Kojima was right about all of it?
I don't want to entertain that possibility. he's been right about enough so far.
Yeah.
Okay. Alice in Los Angeles. Do you have any stubborn habits that you realize aren't practical, but you continue doing anyway? I have two. If I mistype something into Google, I will correct it and research, even though Google knows what I wanted and is showing me the correct results already. I get it. I also will stubbornly try to find articles or blog posts using site navigation, sometimes going back multiple pages in a news section, even though I know searching will be faster. I am 100% with you on that first. Specifically the Google thing where if you misspell something and it's like, did you mean this? We're showing you that anyway. But they give you an opportunity to click on the proper term.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
You know, I understand.
I will always click on that link to the corrected search term, even though they are showing me the exact same search results.
Huh.
It's dumb.
So I just stopped biting my fingernails after 45 years.
Okay. Wow. I did not know you were a nibbler.
I love it. I just can't get enough. It turns out when I get in the car, I bite my fingernails when I'm bored driving.
Huh.
And
while you're driving.
I mean, yeah, you only need one hand to drive.
That's true.
So
I was always a one hand driver as well.
Yeah. So,
I was kind of a one thumb driver a lot of the
time. I would just lick the fingers and put them on the wheel. I'm just
kind of hanging the thumb on the bottom to keep the wheel steady. Oof. I mean, on a straightaway is what I mean.
Yeah. You know, if your tire blows when you got just one thumb on there, that wheel's going to get wrenched around. You're going to go off and
that drive could be off a cliff,
Brad.
That could be a problem, but I also haven't driven in 10 plus years. So.
What weird habits do I mean, I don't know that I, so I used to keep my desktop really organized. And then a few years ago, I just declared desktop bankruptcy and hit all the icons.
Yeah.
And now there's, let's see, I'll tell you how many items, this is air the shame, 443 items on my desktop.
Holy shit, man.
I mean, there's only about 125 folders, so that's good. I probably need to clean this up.
That's horrendous. I mean, I'm with you. I've got, I don't know, a few dozen. Let's see here. Would you just alt enter those things?
No, it's on the status bar on the bottom in your file explorer.
Oh, right. Of course. Yeah, that would be faster.
Most of them are shortcuts to Steam games, it looks like.
Oh, what? I hate desktop shortcuts to applications. That's what the start menu is for.
I agree. Steam.
56. Wow. 56 items for me.
I have every episode of the Tech Pod on my desktop, apparently.
What?
Just my track, the Audacity file.
What? Oh my God. Okay. Well, now there's an email after this we have to move on to after this about being organized. But I religiously delete the Audacity project every week after.
That's probably more responsible.
After everything's put together, I 7-zip up the smallest possible project that could recreate the episode if need be and throw that on my NAS and then delete everything else associated to it.
Yeah, I just deleted 78 Steam shortcuts, so I got that going for me.
That's probably a good thing to do.
I've
got catch-all folders on the right for, like, you know, I've got one for URL shortcuts and like one for media, one for Audacity project. You know what I mean? But things still
need libcrypto-1_1-x64.dll, I can hook you up.
I think I can source my DLLs on my own. Thank you.
Okay. I got a DX Diag here.
Speaking of, geez, man, that's a blast from the past. speaking of bad habits, probably 20 years ago, I developed the nervous tick of absentmindedly right-clicking the desktop and clicking refresh over and over.
Oh, no.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Have you done that? That probably started around, like, I want to say around like maybe Windows 2000 or maybe early XP. There was like something wrong. Well, there was always something wrong with the desktop, right?
Yeah.
There was that.
Your active widgets were not working, right?
Yes.
ActiveX components were broken.
That whole period from Windows 98 on with the active desktop stuff, there was always something broken with the desktop, but... I assume at some point there was something wrong that clicking refresh in the right click menu fixed.
Huh.
And I just got in the habit of doing that without thinking about it. And like now, if I'm just sitting around like at work, if somebody came by my desk and was chatting, I would just sit there like right clicking and clicking refresh over and over and over without thinking about it because it's just a thing to do.
In my first job after college, I was sitting there on like a dual 133 Pentium server one day, upgrading Windows NT 3.5.1 or updating it. And my boss, who was an old, like he'd been doing this for a long time. He was like, man, you're just generating all sorts of extra interrupts doing that. You're just making it take longer with all these interrupts. I was like, it's doing 133 million operations a second times two. We're probably okay. But I didn't say that.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a time when he was probably right.
I mean, quantitatively, he's not wrong.
Yeah, no, no.
Whether the amount of extra nanoseconds is meaningful to you as a human being is another question.
Yeah, I feel like I don't have a whole lot of, I mean, my, the, yeah, no. I think I eat at my desk. That's a gross habit.
Oh, yeah. I get crumbs everywhere. As I feel rooted to this desk in the work from home situation, I definitely eat way too many meals in front of the computer.
Yeah, I used to not, but now I do.
Because I just like spend fucking 12 hours a day at this desk now.
Yeah, I love this room. This is my favorite room in the house. Yeah, I damn well
damn well better be. All right, let's read this next email. It kind of dovetails with that last one. Brian from Boston. Between your day jobs, the tech pod, streaming, and other hobbies and projects of yours, and being a parent on Will's part, I imagine it could feel like your time gets spread a bit thin, or you can feel scattered if you don't stay on top of things. So I was wondering what methods or tools you have for staying organized. I encounter this feeling often. I'm a mechanical engineer by day and have a number of musical projects I work on in my spare time. Damn, let's talk about cognitive load. That's a lot. Along with other secondary hobbies. I've tried making to-do lists, but they only get me so far. So I was wondering what methods you guys utilize for organization.
I have a big, long to-do list.
Like a physical, written, like handwritten one?
There's two. There's one. So a few years ago, I made a magnet board for the fridge that is also like, it's like veneer on metal. So the magnets stick to it. And then I put whiteboard paint on the veneer so that it's, you can write on it. Ooh. But I have a bunch of magnets that are like the common recurring stuff, like Girl Ooh. Scout meetings and soccer and stuff like that.
Wow.
And then you can also write in one-off things.
Man, that's not bad.
And, but that's for the shared family one. So that's like kid stuff, doctor stuff, things we have to go with multiple people. For my personal stuff, I have meetings on calendars, and then I have a big long list of all the to-dos. Cause I used to maintain I do foo stuff. I do Twitch streaming stuff. I do tech pod stuff. And then I'm dad.
Yeah.
And between those four things, I have, like, I used to keep individual to-do list, and that was a disaster. So keeping everything on one giant list made it much more manageable.
Yeah. I like that idea of the physical to-do list, because I feel like if you have to get up and walk to it mm-hmm. and look at it, there is this kind of I assume there's maybe a psychological benefit there of like, you're already on your feet. You've already made the effort to go seek the list out. So like, you kind of have to engage with what's on there and like get on with it.
Yeah. Well, and it's stuck on the front of the fridge too. So like, I can't miss it during the day.
Yeah.
And like, it's just a habit to, when I'm there, look at the thing that's written there for the next couple of days.
That sounds good. Cause I was going to contrast that with, I use the reminders on the iPhone.
Yeah.
Fairly often, but I find them very easy to ignore, especially recurring ones. I'd like for, if it's like, hey, take your medication every morning or whatever, like stuff like that. Yeah. It's just like, I completely just gloss over it. I don't even pay attention to it anymore. So like, I feel like mobile device notifications are not the best way keep up with things. I also find, I don't know about you, like I'm juggling so many more notifications for people sending me messages across half a dozen different chat services these days. Like anything that's not that, and even a lot of those get so buried at this point that like I don't want to get into it too much, but a family member went to the ER a couple weekends ago, and I didn't see it because there were so many other messages that buried the notification that I didn't know about it until the next day. Everything turned out fine, thankfully, but
Well, that's good. Like pruning notifications helps. But yeah, like I used to, like, at the end of the day, I would look at my emails and then I'd make meetings and stuff for things I didn't get invites to. And that's just not tenable anymore. Yeah. So like, what, honestly, this is the thing I use the Google Nest Hub, you know, the voice thing for more than anything else. Cause I can say, hey, make an appointment for 11 o'clock on Friday morning. And if with Brad, and it will make a thing called with Brad for 11 o'clock on Friday morning.
You could probably infer the rest.
Yeah. Well, it's like, it just needs to be there. So I don't forget that I have the fucking, like, yeah. I can go through and find the meeting in my email or DMs or whatever.
Yeah.
But like, it's maddening, especially the Twitch stuff. Anytime somebody wants to pay me something to do something on Twitch, like, not, this is a real, like, this is a good problem to have, but it's like, some stuff comes in on Discord DMs, some stuff comes in on Twitter DMs, some stuff comes on an email. Like, there's 15 different places that I can get. So I've gotten solicitations for sponsored stuff on Twitch DMs, which is just fucking weird. Why would you send a Twitch DM?
Who reads Twitch DMs?
Twitch DMs?
I don't even remember that I have a friends list on there. Yeah. Yeah, I find two things. There's in my head, there's a distinction between the like perfectly organized system of organization and the reality, you know, which is like the idealized version is you have one calendar, you have one messaging service, you have one set of reminders, you have one of everything, right?
Yeah.
But in reality, it's like, I've got three different calendars. Like we are on Outlook and Google email inboxes at work right now because we're transitioning to another company.
Jesus.
Like reminders all over the place, like messages from like I said, six different services. You know what I mean? It's just like,
yeah.
And the other thing I was going to say is like, the more formalized you make your system of organization, the more work it is to the point that it could easily just become another job. I feel like, the more you work to like consolidate all that stuff into one calendar and one inbox and one whatever, like the more of your time it takes up that you could be doing other stuff.
Okay. Look, I got an idea. We need to come up with a snappy name for this.
Are you going to propose like, a lifestyle aggregator?
Minimum viable task list thing is that like, this is a deep thought. This is a good thought. This is like some Tim Ferriss bullshit.
Hang on. Is this a billion-dollar startup idea or is this a democratized like passive house style philosophical idea we're going to put out into the world?
Yeah. Potato, potato. Let's let's not get ahead of ourselves here, but no, I think the minimum viable task list is the approach that works best for me.
Yeah.
Just because I tried 79 folders or whatever that one was. I did the one where you buy the special books from the publisher and like you have the app that looks like the book and the book writes it. Like none of that shit work. And the more overhead there is for it, the less likely I am to actually use it. I set myself a reminder using the Google Voice thing the other day, and then it took me 14 minutes when I got the reminder on my phone to figure out where the reminders were.
The system has failed.
Oh, I fucked up. I've done a bad thing here. So yeah. Minimum viable task list. I'm in.
Imagine being successful and important enough that you can hire somebody else to do all that for you.
A friend of mine once upon a time was like, look, here's the thing. You can do a limited number of things. Your time is valuable. Pay someone to do the things that somebody else can do. I was like, that's great, but you have to have money to pay them.
Yes.
Well, that is where it all breaks down.
That is the rub.
Yeah.
Unless somebody wants to organize my life for me out of the goodness of their heart.
No, you can't pay people exposure for that kind of work.
I'm joking.
Brad.
It was a joke. Being flippant. All right, from minimum viable task lists to Christina's question, minimum setup for live streaming on Twitch or YouTube as an artist or as a gamer? As an artist and as a gamer. I'm sorry. I saw my first response to this, which I think you will challenge, was just point a laptop.
Like, yeah, I think that's fine.
Like you literally, that is a technical answer to the question is like you certainly could literally just use the webcam and the room mic and a laptop.
It's hard to point a laptop at like a hand.
Yeah. Well, I'm not saying it would be a good stream. I'm just saying that like if you in a pinch, if you had to stream something, you could do that.
Well, so I think I have some thoughts about this. I think one of the things that I learned that I didn't appreciate before we started tested 10 years ago is how important audio is.
Yes.
Like it turns out the video can be full potato quality if you have a good microphone.
Vinny was saying that he was offering that as a maxim of production to me recently was that I forget exactly how he phrased it, but like people will forgive bad video way before they will forgive good bad audio. Like,
yeah, well,
if you have to pick one, audio is the one you have to get right.
Yeah. Think about YouTube in like pre-HD YouTube when it was like full potato quality video and like literally everybody else on the planet was doing better quality video and they were like, look, we're just doing volume with garbage video and nobody cares, it's fine. I think buy a decent and just to be clear, a decent mic, we're talking about like $40 or $50 if you're watching for sales. Like Blue Snowballs don't last very long, but they'll get you started and see if there's a business. Like if you think that you're going to be making money on Twitch, then a Blue Snowball or a Blue Yeti for $100 will get you go. I mean, you're using a Yeti right now. They're fine mics.
It's fine. I've had it for, I think, 5 years ish now.
So like the USB comes out of the way the jack comes out of the Snowball is bad compared to the Yeti in my experience.
Okay. I was also, since she mentioned being a gamer, I was going to say like a decent gaming headset is not the worst, you know, like something like I've been using Astro A40s for a very long time. Like, you know, with the little integrated mic, you know, that just bends around to your mouth from the headset like that is an option. Like those mics are not terrible. Like
it's better than using the webcam mic for sure.
Absolutely.
I play games with three people who are using gamer headsets.
Yeah.
And the mics on those are good to very good. They're like fine. They're not broadcast quality, but they're fine for a Twitch stream.
And the one advantage of having a headset mic versus a stationary mic, especially as she says, as an artist, like if you've got a project that you need to move around a little bit and you can't just be rooted to a mic that's stationary on a desk, like that'll help you be a little more mobile around what you're working on.
Well, that's why I use a headset mic for streams, is because then I can move my head and I don't worry about losing the sweet spot on the microphone.
Yeah.
For camera, I use bongo ties, and like you can get they're called like gooseneck tablet holders or gooseneck tripods. And it's basically just a tripod with a clamp on one end that you can clamp onto your table, and a big bendy stiff, like in one of those, you know, it's got like two wires inside a plastic tube, and you can orient it however you want, and it'll stay more or less in that position. And you can like zip tie or rubber band a webcam to that, and then aim your webcam at your work surface when you're like, I use it for doing like Lego and building, like doing soldering and stuff for streams for that. But you could also use it easily for showing your hands when you're drawing or sculpting or whatever.
Yeah. The good news is I don't think there have ever been more and more inexpensive options out there for mic and video stuff for live streaming. Oh,
yeah, no, and I completely forgot. Like there's also that thing Elgato bought. It's called I use it sometimes, the camera thing. Epic Cam Pro. So Epic Cam Pro, it lets you use your phone as a USB camera.
Oh, I didn't think about that. I have a free is that free?
It's $8.
Okay. There's hold up, let me find it's on my phone somewhere.
Well, the benefit of doing this is the camera on your phone is going to be way better than the camera on your even a pretty good webcam on your computer, like your laptop or something. So you can also use that for like handhelds, or you can mount that in one of those brackets as well.
Ah, crap. The app on my phone is just called Webcam. I'm not sure what the full app store name is. Let me see if I can find it real fast.
So the Epic Cam, the thing that Elgato bought, is it works over Wi-Fi if you have AC.
Oh.
Or you can do USB. And like I've used it as a wireless remote before for Twitch streams, which is fun.
I found the app I was looking for. This is weird. It's only $2. They charge for it now. It was free when I got it. Does that happen?
Yeah,
free apps go paid. Yeah,
sometimes people go free to paid.
It's a good app. It's no longer free, but it's only $2, so it's not the end of the world. It's called Instant Webcam by Phobos Lab.
Okay,
which is
I like it that it has lab in the name. That's good.
Yes, that's how you know they mean business. They have a very nice webpage if you want to go there and look at it. Instant-webcam.com.
Okay,
like you can. I've used it a ton. It does require a little bit of network knowledge. Because what it's doing is it actually like you open it and it starts recording or not recording. It starts streaming video and it just straight up slaps an HTTP link with a network address on there. And you open that in a browser. So you're viewing it in a browser window.
So the Epic like camera, EPOC cam.
Yeah.
You just install a OBS plugin and then it just shows up as a source. Ooh, and it's dead simple to use.
That actually sounds a little more convenient. I mean, this works fine for that too, but you have to like capture a browser window manually, or actually you can open it as a browser source in OBS with that address. So that also works. I was
going to say that seems like the right way to do it. Capturing browser sources can be tricky because like Chrome, you can't capture, you can only capture Firefox.
Yeah, it's a little messy, but it's like good quality 30 FPS video through this thing. So those are two good options for like a mobile camera using your phone.
Yeah.
All right. Let's do a couple more here. Dave from Newfoundland. That's in Canada.
I know.
I just got a 3070. And I'm wondering what to do with my 970 that I'm replacing besides just selling it. I'm aware
just
that. okay. Next email. I'm aware that external GPUs are sold as a self-contained unit, but I was wondering if there's a way to take my formerly internal 970 and make it an external that I could plug into a laptop. Is there a kit for this, or am I looking at a more technical procedure? There are definitely kits for this. They're not cheap.
There's boxes. They're not really kits. So
just a kind of a big rugged looking enclosure that you stick your graphics card in.
Yeah, they're called eGPU. The thing you're going to search for is eGPU cases. I looked for reviews that are relatively current, and the most recent ones I could find were from the start of 2020 from sites that I recognized. I've used one in the past. Most of them only fit at most a 2-slot card, and they don't work with, usually they only work with video cards. So like I tried to put a PCI Express capture card in one once, and that just, it didn't know what to do with it. And it was like, I'm not going to expose you to the main PC. They typically connect over USB 3, whatever the current version is when you buy the enclosure.
USB 3?
USB-C 3.1, whatever. Okay. It's the PC. It's the one that exposes PCI Express bus across USB, okay, basically.
Like Thunderbolt type stuff.
It's basically like the USB version of Thunderbolt.
Okay.
The performance is fine. It depends on like whether it's going to be useful depends on the laptop you had. So I plugged it into like a 2016 Razer dual core 13 inch laptop, which is basically like their MacBook Pro kind of chassis, but it's got a huge internal, it's got a 1060 GPU inside. So like there's no, it's all cooling and it's basically all cooling inside the laptop chassis. There's hardly any battery. The dual core CPU had a hard time driving the real GPU was my experience on that for most stuff I was playing. I think like the problem is that the eGPU containers, because they're a kind of specialty item, are really expensive. So you're looking at like $300 or $400 for the enclosure. And I just don't like, you're probably, if you have like a 1060 in a laptop, which is going to be the laptop that will support an eGPU enclosure, assuming you don't have just integrated in that, you're probably going to get better performance off of the built-in GPU than you will the eGPU.
Sounds like a very specialized product for very specialized situations, not just a general purpose. Like, I'm going to get better graphics on my laptop because it's so expensive that what you're getting is probably not worth the money.
Yeah, they're more for people, like the feeling I got is that they're for people who are like plugging into a desk at work and need a bunch of monitors and maybe some 3D stuff.
Yeah.
But are also need to have a laptop to go out in the field. So it's more of like a docking station plus a GPU than just a GPU enclosure.
Right. It's not going to replace a gaming PC, in other words.
The one exception is if you're a maniac and are doing VR development for Mac, where your only option is that or a ridiculously overpriced, you know, Mac Pro.
Yes. An interesting fact about that. The Razer eGPU case that I was looking at right before this explicitly said, hey, don't try to use an NVIDIA card with a MacBook with this because it won't work. Because they only have AMD compatibility.
Yeah. And also like there's 2-slot enclosures. Like I have a 3-slot 1080 Ti. And it just doesn't, there's no way it's ever going to go into an eGPU enclosure. So, and there's like, they're not, it is like, I know people who use those to game with a laptop. It is not a great experience. Like even in an old game like PUBG, you have problems getting that thing to run on a laptop at any kind. What you're doing is creating a bunch of weird bottlenecks where most games don't expect to find bottlenecks and weird stuff happens. So,
Yeah, for minimum $200-$300 for something like that, it just does not seem worth it.
And just to be clear, it's $200-$300 plus the cost of the GPU. So it's not like,
well, in this case, he's got the 970. Well,
But like the point is, it's not like it comes with a GPU that's decent for $300.
Right.
Like one would expect. It's a $300 box that you put a $500 GPU into.
Yes. Let's see. Should this be our last email?
No, we started like 13 minutes in to the recording. Okay. Let's do two more.
Okay. I've got like four to pick from here.
Look, let's. You want to do a speed round?
Oh boy, I don't know. These are somewhat technical. Evan, I'll be moving to the Triangle in North Carolina for work at the start of January, which means I'll finally be free of Comcast. Congratulations, and we'll have access to Google Fiber. Up to this point, I've always bought my own modem and router, but fiber is new to me. Is there anything special I should be looking for in a new router, or is Google's default equipment good enough? Are Cat 6 and 6.8 Ethernet cables fast enough to take full advantage of the speeds offered by fiber internet without introducing any bottlenecks? Are there any unique challenges that come along with fiber internet that I'm not thinking of? As long as you have a router that's fast enough to route gigabit, which Google's still certainly will be.
They'll give you a router that's fast enough.
Also, I think I have to assume pretty much all the consumer grade routers on the market can do gigabit just fine these days.
I don't think that's true.
That may not be true, actually. Like, you might want to look at, like, what is it, SmallNet Builder? Is that the kind of, the de facto router review site that everybody uses? They will have pretty good information on, like, router throughput speed tests if you really want to buy your own stuff.
Yeah, I would. So my recommendation is to start with what they give you. My guess is that they give you the Google Home Wi-Fi router, or the Google Wi-Fi routers, which are pretty good. The mesh network dubbers.
Yeah.
Cat 6 is fine.
Yes.
You'll be great. You want to get good switches.
Gigabit, yeah, absolutely.
But like, a good switch is $20 now. You know, think about the number of ports you need.
Yeah.
And plug them in from there. If you're going to do Wi-Fi, you're going to want the fastest Wi-Fi you can get. But like, look at the number of antennas, not necessarily the number of antennas that you have on both ends, the mobile ends and the router end, are more important than the spec at this point. Because AC and AX, or Wi-Fi 5 and Wi-Fi 6, basically the same performance. Assuming you're not someplace that's super congested, but if like a two antenna solution is going to be faster than a one antenna solution, and a four antenna solution is going to be faster than a two antenna solution for either one. So,
yeah. But just to answer his basic question, there's nothing different about fiber from a copper internet setup as an end user, other than the box that you plug your Ethernet cable into to connect the router. It's on your end, it will be exactly the same. It's just very fast.
Yeah, like the things that are great are the latency goes way down on stuff like real, like the time from when you click a page to when it opens is ridiculous. It's really gross.
It's lovely. It's really good stuff. Everybody should have fast internet.
Enjoy. Yeah. Yes. If I run for president, my platform is going to be fast internet for all.
Dude,
fiber for everyone.
Nationwide. Yeah. Fiber. Make it happen. Yeah. Why stop at one?
Yeah. No. There's 10 gigabit everywhere.
10 gigabit across the country. Let's do it.
Once you put the fiber in, more gigabits are free. That's my understanding of the business. Yeah, we're going to nationalize fiber. I'm sure
it's quite that simple. Let's see. Another quick networking question. This is from Ben. I'll summarize the beginning. He's building a new home. He's going to run Cat 6 Dolls rooms. And he will have a symmetrical gigabit fiber connection. My question is this. Is there a cost or ease or speed benefit to using 2 to 3 wired access points? He's talking discrete access points. Versus the current crop of wireless mesh networks for Wi-Fi coverage.
Ooh.
A speed benefit was alluded to in the most recent Wirecutter review of Wi-Fi mesh network devices, but I'm having trouble finding dedicated answers. Perhaps this is more of an enterprise solution than something for the home. Or maybe the evolution of wireless mesh is an example of the Cheetoification of home networking.
Kind of.
So he's basically taught, like, here's my understanding. You tell me if this is correct. I mean, a mesh network, we've covered this before. A mesh network, the discrete access points are connecting to each other, right? To extend their range. Is that correct?
They can be. They'll work either way. Usually they have a wired port and then they
will also act as an access point.
Yeah. The big advance on the mesh networks. So in the old days, the radios were expensive. So like if you bought one of those wireless access point extenders, it would be splitting time between connecting to clients and connecting back to the mothership.
Right.
With the modern mesh networks, they have multiple radios so they can connect to one or more other nodes while also connecting to clients.
Okay.
They tend to congest the channels more, but it's less of a problem with Wi-Fi 5 and 6 because, you know, AC and AX.
Yeah.
Because do we have a house style on Wi-Fi marketing terms versus actual spec names? Do we do spec names or
I don't know. Marketing?
I'm
partial to 802.11, you know.
It feels weird saying AC for the old thing and
Wi-Fi 6
for the new one.
Yes, I understand. Yes, that's
anyway.
That's what happens when consortiums try to get into branding. They shouldn't do it. Just stick to your alphanumeric product code.
Yeah, own your IEEE standards, dog.
Yes.
So it's better to wire your nodes in. The other thing that mesh networks do is they handle the naming and the channel allocation and that and the security stuff so it stays in sync across all the nodes.
Yeah.
If you don't use a mesh system, you have to do that manually. It's not hard to do, but you need to like you need to make sure that your stuff is set up right and you're not I apologize in advance because I might get this wrong, but I believe you set up multiple nodes with different channels, but the same SSID and same password.
Okay.
So that when your devices are moving between nodes, they'll connect seamlessly to the most powerful SSID with this most powerful AP with the same settings.
So that's what I was going to say. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, but if you don't have all of the, like every setting has to be the same, like the channel width and all of that stuff. So you're connecting like different, like if you're adding old routers as APs and they use different software and they call things different things, you have to be really careful to make sure that your settings actually line up or else the handshake won't be seamless. The handoff won't be seamless.
That's what I was going to ask about. Do you know?
Yeah.
Do you know if, is that noticeable anymore? Do you know? Like
it depends on the device.
Okay.
Cause like Nintendo shit is really bad. Like if you still play games on a 3DS on the internet, which I probably nobody does anymore,
don't but like
you
have house. To
manually switch over if it doesn't, ooh, if you do it wrong.
Okay. I guess we got into that a little bit last week with the 5G stuff where like, yeah, for like we use the example of playing a YouTube video, like they buffer enough that like, even if there is a few seconds of downtime as you hand off to the other node, like the video is probably not going to be interrupted.
Well, but if you're on like a video call or something like that, where you can't buffer 3 seconds, then your call will drop or your it'll pause.
One thing I do wonder about with discrete access points, and maybe this is also specific to the device you're using, is when it knows to initiate the handoff. Like, is it possible that you stay on a node that you're too far away from because it still has some signal, even though it's much weaker than the one that's closer by, but it doesn't like actually trigger the handoff because it still sees something?
So living in a house where this is exactly the setup I have, like in the living room, it'll connect to the AP in the garage, in the bedroom, in the bathroom, in the other side of the house, it'll connect to the AP in my office, and straight up, like it is a problem. Like, huh, like
no kidding.
It depends on the device. Apple devices tend to go for whatever has the highest signal strength. Apple devices are typically better at figuring out the thresholds than the other devices on the regular.
So it sounds like they need some kind of active logic in there, like checking signal strength regularly and initiating the handoff.
I assume that's handled by the OS, but I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. That would make sense to me.
Yeah. In fairness, I don't use a lot of Android device. Like mostly what we use on mobile here are switches and Apple devices.
Yeah.
When I think about it, there's not a whole lot else on Wi-Fi.
Do you have like a one word recommendation for him? I've just got the one access point here, so I don't have experience with this. Would you tell him to go mesh or?
So, I mean, I think you're at the choose your own adventure stage right now, right? You can choose going mesh and getting an Eero or an Orbi or a Google Home. And like you can totally you don't have to use the radio to radio stuff. You can just plug the Ethernet in to those meshes and they work great to those mesh nodes. It's what my dad does at their house. Like they have wired Ethernet to some spots and then the mesh provides a bubble around the endpoint for that Ethernet terminus, which is great. You can also go get like a Ubiquiti standalone edge router plus AP system, which is going to be a little bit more expensive, but in the future when the Wi-Fi standards change, you can upgrade the Wi-Fi standards without replacing your router, which is really nice.
I love that. That is my favorite thing about that setup for sure.
Yeah. And like there's a Ubiquiti mesh product now too. So it'll sync all the settings and handle all the nonsense for you. So you don't have to figure it out. Plus there's a bunch of good guides on how to do that with the just standard APs.
Yes. A lot of options out there.
Yeah.
All right. Last email from John. Want to start off by saying I'm a huge fan of the show, but this week you called a beanie a toboggan, and as one of the snow people known around the world as a Canadian, I felt that I have a certain expertise in this subject. A toboggan is another name for a sled. Typically, these are the ones made out of thin strips of wood, banded together, and then rolled back on the front and held in place with cord. I believe that the word you are looking for is toque. I think there are plenty of different spellings, but that's how we spell it here in the Great White North. John, I have to tell you, this is something that we as Southern transplants have been dealing with for most of our lives.
I didn't realize this was a problem until last week.
Wait, really?
You didn't know? I don't think so. Maybe. I don't know. You've
never encountered this?
I don't wear a lot of toboggans.
No. I also wear a lot of toboggans.
I wear it's a very, dock worker's cap, which is like a toboggan, but I feel like the toboggan has to have the poof on top.
I looked this up earlier, and one of the sources I found said that a toboggan has to be a knit hat.
Yes.
So to back up a little bit, this seems to be an extremely regional Southern thing to call that
My mom's English, and she called it a toboggan.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. She could have picked it. She lived in the South for 20 years before I was born.
I wonder if it's maybe some kind of like Scots-Irish descended sort of cultural quirk or something, maybe?
There was a New York Times article about this kind of stuff for years. You know, the thing where you type in what you call different things and then it tells you where you're from.
Yes.
Down to the county level. And I was like, oh, shit.
Yes. In the southeastern part of the United States, that kind of hat is commonly referred to as a toboggan.
The language is in flux.
Literally all I ever heard it referred to as for the first 20-ish years of my life.
I reckon if you called it a toque when I was a kid, you would have gotten the shit beaten out of you.
Yes, that would not have gone well for you. Or a beanie, for that matter. A beanie, beanie has a propeller on it.
A propeller on the top, yeah, exactly.
A beanie, if it doesn't have a propeller, it's not a beanie. That was my understanding as a child.
A beanie is what you wear if you are pledging a fraternity in the 60s, is my understanding.
Yes, there you go. I also frequently think back to the classic Calvin and Hobbes storyline in which he saved and saved and saved cereal box tops or whatever it was to get the beanie in the mail.
Yeah.
Because it had a propeller on it, because he was convinced that it would help him, it would let him fly.
I mean, it worked, right?
It was a harsh lesson. A harsh lesson was learned.
I've never ridden on the kind of sled that was described by John as a toboggan.
I don't think I have either.
We only had enough snow, like maybe twice in my childhood, to use the kind of sled that has runners instead of like a big plastic sheet.
Snow was a very infrequent, like magical occurrence in that part of the world.
We had a couple of historic
blizzards in my childhood time frame, but not like the foot plus of snow was like maybe once or twice a winter or something like that.
Yeah, like it was exciting. It was a snow day. Snow days were always. We built an igloo once.
Wow, that's impressive.
You know, Dad hooked the yard box up to the tractor and just dragged about a half an acre worth of snow into one big pile. And then we all stomped it down and hollowed it out. And it stayed up for a long time. It was like having a clubhouse in the front yard. It was awesome. Really muddy inside, it turned out, after a while.
Yeah, that part of the world, that part of the country, snow was infrequent enough that when it happened, it was both exciting and the municipal infrastructure was so inequipped to handle it that everything shut down. No school, no driving anywhere, no nothing. If there was like 6 inches of snow on the ground, because nobody could deal with it.
Hold on. Did one of your parents have the instinct that as soon as it stopped snowing, they were like, I got to go out and see how bad it is. And they'd get in the car. Cause that was my dad's move every time.
Oh, wow. No, not quite. That's some real, that's some real like Clark Griswold, like Christmas story, like cantankerous old dad type shit.
It was some real dad vibes. Like we would load up in the car, just me and him usually in the four wheel drive, like the farm pickup truck, the one that was mostly, we did not have farm use tags on it, but we could have. And we would pop it into four wheel and go out and drive around and see how bad the roads were after he saw the plow go by the first time. And only had to pull it out of the ditch once. So that was pretty good.
Okay. That's a good track record.
That's okay.
Yeah. Yes.
I think that's a lot of emails. We got through almost everybody this week.
That's true. This task has really proved its worth.
I know.
I'm pretty excited about this new paradigm. Is this a paradigm shift?
I feel like something shifted.
Can we get like, I don't know, can we have a TED talk about how this has changed our lives?
I would like to talk about a tertiary product attached to Google Mail that has changed my life.
Actually,
I feel like they're going to reject that one. Yes. I don't know.
Well, also, you can't do a TED talk about a Gmail feature because it will cease to exist in 6 months.
Oh, no. We just started using this. They can't take it away.
That's exactly how they get you.
Don't inbox us, bro.
What is that? There is a website. You know, the whole subgenre of websites that is just a pithy domain. Like,
you mean single-use websites?
Has so-and-so happened yet? And it's just a big fat yes or no kind of thing.
Yeah, is Trump still president?
Yeah, stuff like that. There's one of those for Google products that have been killed off, and I can't remember what it is. It's going to kill me if I can't think of it right now. Products that have been killed off. Let's see if I can find it. It's totally like a, I don't know. It's like it has Google killed it yet type site or something like that. I can't remember what the name is. It's going to kill me. Somebody will send it in.
Yeah, we'll get it. Yes. If you have the answer to that question or have questions you would like to have turned into answers, you can email them to techpod@content.town. We'll be back next week with another episode of the show. Oh, we got to thank Patreons. Holy yes, crap. I'm remiss.
We wouldn't be here without them.
I know. Wow. I'm off this week. So as always, if you would like to contribute to the Tech Pod, you can by going to patreon.com/techpod. For $2 a month, you can get access to the fabulous Tech Pod Discord, which is full of wonderful, wonderful nerds who talk about all sorts of interesting things we're doing. I don't want to say who it is, but this month we're doing a new thing for the patron exclusive episode, where we're interviewing a noteworthy patron, I think is probably a safe way to say what they do.
Someone in a very interesting line of work.
Yeah. We can't say what they do, but if you're in the Discord, you can look around and there's a pinned topic.
I'm very excited about that conversation.
Me too. We're doing it tomorrow. So, as always, I want to make sure we thank our executive producer level patrons, Jacob Chappell, Andrew Cotton, David Allum, and James Kamek. Thank you all so much for supporting the show. And thanks everyone who supports the Patreon, whether you're at the $2 tier or whatever. We appreciate it. And if you don't, if you can't support the Patreon, we get it. We understand it's a weird time right now. Tell your friends about the show.
Yeah.
Tell your nerd peeps.
Yeah. Thank you to everybody who supports us and everybody who listens. It remains gratifying and baffling that anyone would, but thank you so much.
We say this a lot, but like I love getting up in the morning and ducking into one of the like two main channels. Like, there's two main channels in the Discord that get a lot of traffic. And then there's a bunch of sub channels that also get a lot of traffic now.
Yeah.
But general in this week's episode, there's always a good conversation happening in one of those. People this morning were like, I get up and I feel like I spend the morning reading the catching up on the Discord. And so everybody else was like, oh no, don't do that. Just dip in. It's imagine like there's a good conversation happening at the end of your hallway and you could just duck in anytime you want to learn something interesting or weird. And it's all in there. I was talking about Ted Lasso in movies and television this week.
Oh,
Ted Lasso is pretty good, Brad.
Yeah.
He's a mustache.
I don't know who or what that is, but.
Oh, Ted Lasso is a TV show. It's about an American football coach who goes to the UK to coach a English football team.
Sorry, I don't have time to keep up with your TV and pop culture. I'm too busy over here reading one of the physicists on our Discord talking about the propagation of light through fiber. If you're multiplexing different wavelengths to increase bandwidth and throughput, dispersion becomes more and more of a problem. That's one of the takeaways from that conversation.
There you go.
I mean, I love that there are people who have actual physics backgrounds talking about how fiber works in a mathematical sense.
There was a conversation the other day about the difference between the relationship between frequency and bandwidth on a channel. And how like VHF and UHF TV channels had different bandwidth slices allocated to them.
I have to look that up. That sounds like that. Good. That sounds like it came out of the 5G episode, as did this fiber conversation. Actually,
it did.
The way this fiber thing started was people talking about the speed of light through materials. Because the speed of light is actually only the speed of light in a vacuum.
Yeah, it's a lot slower in water. That's why water refracts.
Totally. So they were actually getting into like very quantitative breakdowns of how different materials affect the speed of light, which it's, is pretty awesome. And that's how the fiber thing started.
Well, whoever explained the VHF UHF thing explained it in using concrete real world examples of things makes them much easier to understand than making them theoretical. So, I just knew that the chalk on the old manual TV we had when I was a kid was rotating through 10 megahertz of spectrum. So
that classic chonk.
Imagine if your TV had like a smooth dial so you could dial that in perfectly rather than
like a radio.
Like a radio.
Huh.
Like why did it not have that? Why did it have chonk? I guess it had chonks because it was like honing in once you got, I don't know.
I guess so.
Radio engineers, let us know next week.
Yeah. We should find one. Get them on here.
Yeah, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back next week with more Tech Pod. Have a wonderful holiday season. Stay safe and wear a mask out there, folks. We'll see y'all next week.